Happy Tuesday, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome. My show is all about celebrating life, celebrating art, celebrating artists, and I can't think of a better artist to celebrate today than Jim Wilson. His new book, Tuned In, is a fascinating read. I've loved this book because it covers all of the areas that I'm really interested in as an artist myself and as an avid reader, celebrating what makes music tick within each and every one of us. And Jim, I'm welcome to the show. And as I do with all of my shows, besides the fact that your book is about to hit everywhere, what are you celebrating today?
I'm celebrating being with Richard Skipper this morning.
Well, thanks for that.
That's cause for celebration.
Well, thank you.
I'm celebrating approaching the finish line with this. It's writing an 86,000 word tome is such an epic undertaking. And Richard, I started in the pandemic. I thought, well, gosh, I got no excuse now. I need to start cobbling some of these stories together because I've always been told, oh my God, these are such fun stories that you've got, should put them on paper. And so I started cobbling them together and realized, well, this is about a much bigger narrative than just, you know, fun hangs with McCartney and Elton John. I mean, that's fun and some extraordinary one-off opportunities that I've had. But really, it's about the bigger narrative of how did I get there? You know, why on earth did I end up on the same piano bench as Paul McCartney singing Beatles songs and limo rides with Elton John and horseback riding with Fogelberg, a dear friend and hero of mine. So it was just this epic undertaking that, and I'm a perfectionist. So as I kept going, I thought, well, I really want to do this right. So I studied, you know, the craft of writing and structure and studied with two different writing coaches and I'm happy to say here I am 4 years later. I'm approaching the finish line. I'm very, very happy with the result. And I'm so honored and humbled by all the clients who've stepped up and said, yeah, we love your book and we'd love to give a quote. And from Ray Romano and Courtney Cox to Diane Warren and Carol Bayer-Sager and
Martin Short.
Yeah, Marty, dear Marty, how much do you love his quote?
I adore this book, and I do. I adore it as well. There's so much to unwrap here. As much as the pandemic hurts so many people,
yes,
I think when it comes to artists, it ignited sparks in so many artists that I've had on the show that because rather than hitting that roadblock head on, you went around the roadblock by tapping into, first of all, writing, this is your first book.
Yeah. Well, aren't we kind of touching on the very nature of art itself, you know, turning poison into medicine, you know? So that's kind of our role as artists, any artist, be it music, writing, dance, painting, is to take that common human pain and to turn it into something that hopefully can be an inspiration for others and shine a light in a dark time.
Absolutely. Writing is a very solitary yes. art form.
Yes.
What was your process in terms of writing this book? Did you keep journals as you've grown up, or was it total recall, or how did it all come back for you?
I did keep some journals, and ironically, Richard, they didn't come into play as much as I thought. Mm. Looking at some old pictures did kind of trigger some memories, but once I kind of saw where this was going, I laid out an outline. Okay, here's our prologue, you know, sitting on the same piano bench as Paul McCartney and singing Beatles songs, and then in the limo ride back to London from his studio on the south coast of England, saying, how the hell, as an insecure West Texas kid, end up there, this four-hour hang, at the end of which he says, anytime you're in the UK, just give us a bell. Yeah, and I would. I went to his home studio like a dozen times and used to call him with a joke. And And so, you know, you just kind of think, how do you get here? And so I started kind of following the thread, you know, it's kind of like unraveling the sweater. Well, it kind of traces back to this one little moment when I was 7 years old. My mom says, hey, will you want to join me on a little errand? She's going to go return something that she borrowed from a friend. Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, that it beats doing some homework. So I jumped in the car with her and we went over to her friend. His name was Toy. What an interesting man, name for a man, right? Toy. So my mom and Toy are over there talking about grown-up stuff, drinking Chardonnay. I'm, you know, seven-year-old boy, I'm bored out of my mind. And I look over in the corner, Richard, and I see this old guitar, and I think, oh, interesting. I've never played one. I saw Roy Rogers play one on TV, so I went over and started plunking around on it. And sorry, this...
You're going to do a lot of crying today. They call me the...
Let me finish this thought, please. It's an emotional moment because this one gesture. So this guy Toy, as we were leaving, he said, I saw you plunking around on that guitar. Do you like it? I said, yeah, it's cool. He goes, take it. It's yours. Mm. So with those four words, he changed the direction of my life. And it goes to show you how you never quite know what your gestures, what things you do for other people, how it's going to impact their lives. And one of the themes in my book is called The Power of One. Mm-hmm. And how one moment, how one interaction, how one gesture from a friend, how one random occurrence can change the direction of your life. And so that was the first of four major, you know, power of one moments where this one gesture just pointed me in a direction. And because he gave me this guitar, I could now kind of plunk around on this guitar and discover music on my own terms. Whereas just months before, my mom had wanted me to take piano lessons and I doth protest. And I thought, man, if music is about these stupid dots and sticks on a page, I don't want anything to do with it. Every good boy does not necessarily do fine. So when I got this guitar, man, I can start picking out melodies on guitar, and it really did change the direction of my life.
And it's funny that you started with this. I actually circled the word guitar in your book because I feel the same way. It's these moments, we may think they're random moments, but I don't think they're random. I think it's part of our destiny that moment happened exactly when it was supposed to happen. You also go into detail with some of the turmoil that was surrounding you at that time. And then I feel that music was a saving grace for you. And you said Absolutely. You were putting out everything on your guitar from My Fair Lady to whatever you heard on the radio.
Right. And you know, so much of it does come from my parents. My mom especially had this place in her heart for folk music. She loved Joan Baez. She worshiped her. And so around the house, I would hear Joan Baez and My Fair Lady, as you said. And there's this one seminal moment where she's singing, oh, Shenandoah, I long to hear you far away. She's singing that, and I can see this misty look in her eyes, and it's expressing some kind of deep sentiment. And I think at that moment, I kind of understood at a cellular level how music can really speak to one's innermost spiritual beauty and express that angst that so much more than we're able to say with words. And I kind of got that at an early age. And honestly, Richard, I hear fragments, I hear echoes of that melody in stuff that I compose today, because that's kind of in my melodic DNA, if you will, that kind of folk Appalachia, the nice open melodies with a big, beautiful shape. Yeah.
Yeah. So many things that pop out for me in this book. I mean, you mentioned, of course, and we're going to talk about that a little later on, these incredible celebrities that have become a part of the fabric of your life.
Yeah.
When I think about hearing your stories, I'm thinking not from your point of view, but from their point of view.
Okay.
How great it was to meet you.
Aww.
And have you be a part of their lives.
Right.
Because, you know, I see with so many people, and I've been very fortunate in terms of my own circle of friends, that right. people will say, oh my God, you're not going to believe who I met last night. And I always follow that up with, but they met you as well.
Right.
And I think that's very important. Another pivotal moment was when your grandmother came to live with you. And I love the story that you tell about creating, as you put it, your first man cave. So if you can talk about that.
Right. Well, that is another one of those little moments that is a defining moment. So my blind grandmother, French Canadian, she came to live with us when my brother was born. He was born in 64, year of the Beatles and year of Kennedy. You know, Kennedy had just been assassinated. And I mean, it's just a very turbulent time. And my parents were getting divorced. And it was just a really turbulent time in the world and for me as well. So our grandmother came to live with us, and now she's going to get that bedroom, and I was the odd man out. Well, here's a little day bed in the kitchen that you're going to get to sleep on, Jimmy. And my dad had moved out by that point, and I hated that situation so much, because people would come in and middle of the night and flick on a light, and, you know, and it was just kind of humiliating. And there was a big closet an oversized closet that my dad had used as a dark room for his photography stuff, with all sorts of chemicals and stuff. It was packed to the gills with everything, gallon jars of developing solution and blah, blah, blah. And so I'd asked my mom, hey, do you think maybe I could use that as a bedroom? And she said, well, we'll have a discussion about that, which means never. So as my first big act of self-determinism, one night I waited till everybody went to bed, and then slowly but surely I took my little day bed, quietly disassembled it, put it up against the wall. I took each bottle one by one and took it out and put it where my bed had been. And suddenly the entire contents over a period of 2 hours were now where my bed had been, the boxes stacked up, but I was doing it very quietly so as not to wake anybody. And then I moved my little bed in there in this windowless room, no air, no ventilation. But let me tell you, this was heaven, because this was my man cave. This is my statement. I deserve this. And I'm not going to wait for somebody else to tell me what's right or wrong. I'd rather, you know, apologize later than to ask permission and get denied. So I just went for it. I just still remember when I woke up, I heard my mom go, oh my God, when she saw this stack of, you know, everything. But that was a lesson that I learned early on that carried me through later in life. And that is, insurmountable objects, obstacles are not insurmountable they're surmountable if you break them down one by one. So that whole closet was just completely full, and that's a daunting task. But you pick up one bottle, you move it, and you place it elsewhere. You go in and you get the second bottle. And so that lesson of being able to break down huge tasks into doable chunks, that served me so well later in life, getting a record deal, producing my first big concert, selling out the Globe News Center in Amarillo, the 1300 seat, you know, one by one, putting butts in seats. And this enormous project, I broke it down task by task, you know. So it's something that really helped me later in life.
You write in your book that there were four life lessons that you learned from that experience. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not thinking that as that was happening, that you were consciously thinking of those. Are those life lessons that you've thought about since that moment, or were these life lessons that came to you as you were putting the words to paper for this book?
I would have to say ex post facto. It was after the fact. I kind of looked back. I certainly did realize at the time that, and I did have this epiphany as a kid, and I was like, okay, this seemed like an undoable task, but I did it one little thing at a time. And those are lessons that have stayed with me for decades.
I keep getting these moments in your life that were turning points, and I want to talk about two of those. One, February 9th, 1964.
There's an army, there's a legion, there are legions, hundreds of thousands of artists today who you ask them, what was it that made you get into music? Watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
Man, I want to share a very funny story with you, and then I'm going to shut up.
Yeah.
Mitzi Gaynor was a good friend of mine.
Yeah,
I love it. A good friend of mine. And she told me this story that when she got booked to do the Ed Sullivan show, she asked her agent who else was going to be on the show that night. And he said, this new group called the Beatles. And she said, thank God nobody's ever heard of them. This is great.
Right. I'll be top dog.
Right. She's going to be top dog. She said she was sitting in her dressing room. And all of a sudden, there was such a roar that she thought that the subway was coming right through the building. She had never felt or heard anything like that in her life. Yeah. It startled her. She jumped out of her seat, stepped out of the dressing room, and she said, what is going on? And they said, the Beatles just hit.
Yeah. What a moment in American music history, in history at all. I mean, that moment just spawned so many artists, so many kids who went, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. And it had never been done. These four mop top lads from Liverpool who said, you know, we love the classic songwriters. We love the Carole Kings or the Jerry Goffins. We love these well-crafted hits. And why don't we break the paradigm? Why don't we write our own stuff? It wasn't done, you know, mm-hmm. It wasn't done. You'd always, you know, the paradigm was Pat Boone. You get a singer, a popular singer, and the A&R man says, well, I think you'd do good with this one. And, you know, and around that time, there was a song around that time was, how much is that doggy in the window? Just, you know, cute stuff. And here these guys coming on, she loves you, yeah. And it just was a nuclear explosion. And I'm honored to have been a part of that. And so that moment compiled with, you know, all the records of theirs that burned into my DNA and how they shaped not just my life, but the whole world. And then there's that moment when you first meet him. And we're kind of jumping ahead in the story, but, you know, I helped to develop the first MIDI adapter for acoustic piano back in the mid 80s, which led to meeting McCartney and Elton and, you know, I was the only guy on the planet you could get this MIDI adapter from and have it installed. And I got flown to England a dozen times by McCartney and Elton and Phil Collins and Keith Emerson, blah, blah, blah. But
you open your book with that story.
I do. But I also want to kind of jump to what that moment is like, because you're talking about the Ed Sullivan show and then the decades of influence that it has on you. And then there's that moment of actually meeting a Beatle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get the feeling you've met plenty of celebrities and people, movers and shakers. And it's fun. It's great to be in that jet stream. But Richard, let me tell you, there's meeting celebrities, there's meeting royalty. And then there's meeting a Beatle. There's just something in you that when you actually see them in the flesh, it's so beyond your mind's ability to comprehend. So that first 30 minutes, I had to kind of be there because I'm on a mission. I had to be professional. Pleasure to meet you. And I'm going to do this, and this to your piano. By the way, the touch is a little heavy. I'm a piano technician. I can address that if you want. And the tone is blah, blah, blah. Yeah, sure, go for it. Have at it. Well, that was a Friday around 4 or 5 in the afternoon. So I had my work cut out for me because he was going to come tomorrow morning at Saturday at 10 to hear what I'd done. So I worked into the night till around 1 in the morning, showed back up at the studio at 10, and he comes in. He's in a wonderful, playful mood. And by this time, I've gotten over the initial shock. Okay, well, that's he really does exist. It's not a fantasy. And he was in a good mood, and I kind of tapped into that and thought, okay, for whatever strange reason in the universe, this is really happening. You really are here with Paul McCartney, and he's listening to you explain how the MIDI adapter works, and by golly, he's in a mood to kind of joke around and play around. And I started easing into that moment, and it just became this incredible thing with him, you know, with us talking about and the limo ride back to London. I'm starting to write down all these things we talked about, you know, this whole long list of things, because when you're in the middle of a conversation, it's flowing and going and you're not thinking about it. So after the fact, I'm writing, okay, we talked about Jimmy Page, we talked about Yoko, we talked about the Beatles. We sang a Beatles song. He told me, you know, it was incredible. So there's meeting celebrities, and then there's meeting a Beatle.
But you know, there are these, I call them full circle moments.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
People that I grew up idolizing on television, hearing right. their music, and to know that they're part of I call it the fabric of our lives.
Absolutely.
Now,
yes.
It's mind boggling.
Yes.
And I get this feeling that you have this quality about yourself that puts these celebrities at ease, because I know what it's like to be with some of these celebrities, and a lot of people are on the take, you know this,
yeah.
And that's not your situation.
Yeah.
But the fact that you're there to offer them something that they need in their lives, whether it be good conversation, friendship, music, whatever, you deliver the goods.
Well, it certainly does help to be ushered in with a glowing referral from one of their contemporaries. Let's start with that. And I've been on the flip side of that, where, you know, some celebrity out in the wild, and you know, you try to introduce yourself and you sound like you fumble all over yourself and you get tongue-tied. But you know, with pretty much every client that I've ever had, I've been ushered in. David Foster says you're the greatest, or I just recently got a new client, Queen Latifah. She called Quincy, and you got to call Jim Wilson, you know. So there's nothing like being ushered in at that level, and it's a different introduction than, "Hi, I'm a big fan, and can I have your autograph?" And
exactly.
And that guy lives within me, I assure you. So I'm just fortunate enough to be doing something that is of service to them, and that's a great feeling to contribute to their lives, you know.
There's another moment in your life that got to me, and that was when your father, I call this father-son bonding moment.
Yes.
Where you go to the drive-in movie to
yeah.
see a Paul Newman film winning. And
good for you, yeah.
Yeah, and you, obviously, your father thinks it's going to be a race car movie, this is what we're going to go see.
Right.
And that moment also triggered something within you. Not only the emotional aspect, because it is about the breakup of a family, but it was the culmination. I don't want to give away too much of your book. I love this book, by the way.
Give
away too much, but the culmination of drama and music coming together.
Yes. Yeah. And doesn't that speak volumes about the ability of music to penetrate beyond words, beyond thoughts? You know, it's the winning, the movie you're talking about. My dad and I jumped in the pickup truck and went to go see this in the outdoor, in the drive-in theater. And it's a great movie, but Dave Grusin's score, there's something about that just, he's a big influence. And I'm sure this is a pivotal moment for me. How he used the music to really be the third character, as they call it. Music is the third character in the film. So there's the two people on camera, and then the third character, is this music and what it's saying and doing. And I just remember bursting into tears at the end of it, because it had spoken to me about a broken home, and the music really underscored that. So yeah, the power of music. Aren't we fortunate to be in that universe where we can create music and create art and hopefully be of service to people?
What was the experience like for you of looking back on your life as you sit down to write your memoir, to put this story on paper, and to revisit these moments in your life, the good, the bad, and the ugly? They're all there. And how do you choose what stories you are going to share? Because I'm sure there are many that are not there. How did you make those choices?
Well, ultimately, I just began writing kind of everything. And then the barometer was, does this serve the narrative? And that's ultimately, that became the go, no go point, where I had to kill a lot of darlings in this, you know, some fun stories. And it's like, it's fine and well, but does this really serve the narrative of an insecure kid from West Texas discovering music as a means of salvation, moving to Los Angeles, getting sidetracked by a successful piano servicing career, becoming kind of wrapped up in the glitter of a showbiz town that values appearance over, you know, substance. And then ultimately, spoiler alert, it's okay, my best friend dies of a heart attack at the age of 37. And that was the thing that made me go, holy shit, there's no guarantees. I'd kind of been skipping along, as, you know, there's always going to be more tomorrows and you'll always get a chance to do this. It's like, no, man, this could be, you can get that tap on the shoulder at any nanosecond. It's like, it's done. Pencils down, turn in your assignment as is, whatever you've done so far, that's it. So I had just been with my friend Claude. I'm a bit of a softie, so you'll have to bear with me.
I am too, so I might join you.
Been with my friend Claude, closest friend. He had songs cut by Celine Dion. He was David Foster's right-hand man. He was living the dream, Richard. I thought, man, this is it. And we had these mastermind sessions where we'd talk about creative visualization. And, you know, we supported each other in our dreams. And I could, his dream was so lucid. Man, I'm going to have a wife and kids, and I can see my kid coming in to wake me up to make pancakes. And, man, ladies and gentlemen, watch this guy, you know, because this is how it's done. Then he played me this sonata on piano that he'd written. You know, he's this big arranger and songwriter, and everybody, you know, he's well respected, but he's going to step out as a solo artist. And I think, wow, people watch this. And this sonata was so stunning. And then just here we are weeks later, I'm in the hospital room, I'm holding his cold hand, and I'm thinking, what the hell happens to those dreams now? So I could see how quickly and easily those dreams, as glorious and as clear as they are, how quickly they just kind of vaporize into a million particles.
I know. I lost a very dear friend of mine last year, and she spent the last 15 years of her life, she had written a musical, believe it or not, about Liberace. And every waking moment of her life was devoted to getting this show to Broadway. Yeah. I'll bring it myself here. And when she died suddenly of a heart attack, the first thought that went in my head was, I hope it was all worth it.
Right.
Because, yeah. I mean, we're so driven. I'm a very driven person. I know you are as well.
Yeah.
Is it, if the process was fun for her,
right,
then it was worth it.
Right.
And that's what we have to tap into.
Yes. The process. Yes. That I'm often asked, what common thread do you find working with all these celebrities? And that's, you just tapped on it, which is learning to love the process. Uh-huh. You know, here's McCartney, who's written a million songs, more classic hits than anybody on earth. And he's had enough, made enough money for himself, for his grandkids' grandkids to live off of. But here he is, and he's got an art studio, and he paints, you know, just because he loves the creative process. And so, you know, for your friend, and I'm sorry for your loss, but there is that kind of heartbreaking poignancy of like, oh, those dreams. And yes, I hope it was worth it. I hope you enjoyed the process. Mm-hmm. But there's also the flip side of that. Oh God, whatever it is that you wish to aspire to in life, get the hell on with it. And certain dreams are more accomplishable than others. And, you know, I know friends who've worked on Broadway musicals and try, you know, that's a commitment, man. And it's all on spec. That's, mm-hmm. that's years and years of your life.
Well, look, I mean, Barry Manilow, 20 years to get yes. harmony to Broadway.
Yes.
And it closes, you know, after yeah. a few weeks.
Yeah.
You know, oh. and these moments happen all the time. I want to go back. I'm going to go way back with you for just a moment.
Okay.
I asked for a photograph of you at 5 years of age. There's a reason that I do this.
Okay. I love that.
To me, the five-year-old self is the purest self. It's before life begins to put layers on you. It's before life begins to tell you who you are,
right.
who you should be, who you shouldn't be. And of course, we learn a lot about your childhood in your book. But when you look at this photograph, and I love the expression on your dog's face and yours.
Yes.
What do you remember about this photograph?
Well, I will tell you, my dear Aunt Billie Jo, my dad's sister, she never had kids of her own, so she kind of became the adoptive mom of my sister Jenny and I, and ultimately Paul. And she just loved to do these kind of things. She'll have us for the weekend, and she took me to Olin Mills, which is a photo. Oh, was that a national chain? You yeah, seemed you light up.
Hold on.
Yeah.
This is you my have, Olin Mills.
Oh, stop it! That's oh, look at that cute boy. What happened? What happened
know,
to that
I know,
cute boy?
I know.
You were so cute. You're still adorable.
I know.
But so that's, you asked me what I remember. Well, there's the flat top haircut. You know, that's my uncle's doing. He's taking me every Saturday or whatever for the flat top, a crew cut, mm-hmm. flat top haircut, whatever. And then, of course, she dressed me in the cute little vest and her dog, Pepper. And so that's what I remember about that. And, you know, it's innocence of childhood. You're so right. There we go. Yeah. A picture of me and my sister and my dad, as I mentioned, he was quite actually a good photographer. And mm-hmm. he took that one and got a little moment, didn't he? That's a great
photo.
Yeah.
I've got a photograph just like that of my sister and myself.
Okay.
And it's those moments are just... Right. You know, a part of, I mean, as you go back and you're looking at this, I'm sure that if you're like me, you're probably pinching yourself at these moments that have happened in your life. And yeah. some of them are fleeting and some last a little longer than others.
Yeah.
As you were writing your book, and of course, I understand he's the Beatle, he's above all else.
Yes.
You chose to start your book with this story. Why this story among the many others that are in your book?
Well, like I said, you know, there's meeting a celebrity and there's meeting a Beatle. And it's just this, that moment is emblematic of me kind of getting wrapped up in the stardom of Hollywood. There's a little bit of that, but it's, let's see, why did I choose that moment? Because he was a hero above all heroes. And, you know, he wrote music that changed the world. And it's amazing how deeply into my DNA that music got baked. And I suppose I could have chosen another moment, but this one was more profound to me. So it wasn't just, I chose that moment, not just because it's amazing to be the Beatle, but also because it had this profound impact on me. I don't know if you remember in my book, I talked about there's a term in Indian spirituality, it's called Shaktipa, mm-hmm. right? So Shaktipa is when you are in the presence of a guru who is much more higher consciousness, elevated vibration. Well, we are all at our atomic level, not to get too woo-woo here, but I mean, it's real.
We're all just with me.
So we're all just kind of vibrating at different levels. And when you are in the presence of an enlightened guru, like a tuning fork, if he's vibrating at this higher frequency, well, that part of you which is capable of vibrating at that, it will sympathetically vibrate. And so in a similar fashion, being with McCartney and kind of having these experiences of being in his creative jet stream, and as you read later in the book, I had the chutzpah to go, my God, I just had this great hang with McCartney. He's a great friend now, and I can call him and say, hey, let's write a song. Well, that's the naive Texas boy in me. And sure enough, he was down for it. Well, yes, come on over. So we had tea and bickies with him and Linda, and it was really lovely, and had the pleasure of playing this song for him. He really liked the idea, and he goes, yeah, it's nice, play that again. So I did it again, and then the second time around on this chorus that he just now heard, boom, pops in with this perfect harmony that follows me through a little key change in the middle, and it's just, you're just kind of hanging on going, wow, this is crazy. Paul McCartney is singing a harmony to this song that he's contemplating, right? Well, what would we call it? And the song had the idea had this, so I'll be here tomorrow. And so, I like the one word titles, maybe tomorrow, so I've already got a song called Yesterday. Oh, you do? How does that one go? Maybe how many bars from you? I might have heard it.
I love it.
but that was a moment really that being in that jet stream and kind of nothing ever came of it, but just to kind of be in that little jet stream for 20 minutes or so, just to kind of kicking around an idea and have harmonies to it and what would we call it? And I like this part, and it really had a profound impact on me. And my melodies from that day forward rose to a different level, just because you realize a different reality is possible,
Absolutely. And that's the title of your book, Tuned In. Was this the original title for the book, or was it always going to be Tuned In?
I kind of struggled with what is it going to be? It took me, I was a couple of years into the 4-year process, and I toyed with, somebody said Confessions of a Hollywood Piano Tuner. Well, it's a little salacious, and it doesn't really speak to the higher narrative mm-hmm. of me discovering myself as an artist. And thank goodness, a dear friend of mine, another songwriter, she said, what about Tuned In? And it's like, perfect, because it speaks to the obvious of piano tuner, tuning pianos. But as I mentioned, the last third of the book, and really the most important part of my narrative, is me tuning in to my higher purpose as an artist. So when my friend Claude died, I had to kind of look and, I made that determination. I'm not going to let that happen. I'm going to take no prisoners. I'm going to do whatever I can to make my dream come true. Well, what is my dream? Because the original dream, Richard, was I moved to LA to become the next Jackson Browne. And instead, I became the next Jackson Browne piano tuner. So it was all fine and well to be tuning for celebrities. And that was really cool. But that whole singer-songwriter thing didn't quite really ring true for me anymore. Well, I had these collection of pieces that I had composed for my own amusement on piano. And no one's ever going to hear these, but my gosh, it sure does feel great to play around with this B minor pattern. And ooh, this sharp five here sounds really cool. And I just enjoy playing these, so I had a collection of these that I was really composing for myself. And when Claude died, that was when I said, okay, if I get that tap on the shoulder like Claude did, or my brother did, I'm going to have something that I leave behind where people go, okay, this is what he was really made of. This is what's in his heart as an artist. And that's when I created my first album, Northern Seascape. And there was something about the purity of that, some fairy dust kind of sprinkled on that. And all my friends came to my support. The first person I called with hopes of him joining in was my friend Davey Johnstone, the guitar player for Elton John for way back in the day. Lovely, lovely guy. And before I could even muster, I said, you know, son, I'm going to start working on a solo record. And I'm kind of trying to gather my nerve to ask him to play it. Oh, that's great, man. You want me to play on it? It's like, oh. And then he and Dave Cause and everybody kind of rallied. And there's something when you are really tuned in to your purpose, your higher, truer purpose, the universe just unfolds and doors open, and it's a magic thing that happens. And it created that first album. And to cut to the chase, it led to kind of a bidding war with 7 different labels. And ultimately Angel EMI put a big fat check on the table and said, okay, that's it. And that one went to number 21 on the Billboard New Age charts. It's not exactly new age because it's more like folk pop melodies with different, you know, piano featured instrumentalities, but they have to put it into one chart. It's either new age or the smooth jazz. So they put me into new age, but made it to number 21. And then here I am 10 albums later and 4 times on the Billboard charts and 75 million streams of my music and 2 PBS specials.
That's amazing. Just amazing. Do you think this book would have happened if the pandemic had not happened?
That's a good question. Just in the same way that it took the passing of my friend Claude to put a flame under my butt and go, get on with it. You may have a point. You may have landed on a point that it was the pandemic and just bringing not only my world to a halt, but the entire world to a halt, that made me go, okay, you got no more excuses now. Let's get on with these things that you've been putting off, and created a couple of music videos. And then I began cobbling these stories together and learning the craft of writing. And like I said, it was like pulling a little thread on your sweater, and it just kind of kept unraveling. And studied with 2 different writing coaches. One was in South Africa. I'd have these weekly Zoom meetings with her, and we'd go over what I'd written and learn the basics of writing. Show, don't tell. You know, don't tell me about it, show me. So, and then also, how did that make you feel? It's about the craft of dropping people into a scene as opposed to just giving a summary. This happened and that happened and that happened. So I learned the trick of kind of dropping somebody into a scene and then doing some world building, as Stephen King described it in his book about writing, doing some world building. And I noticed the glow of the red clock above the bar. It said 8:22. I'm late. And through the smoky bar, I saw you start painting a picture for the reader. And man, what a fun process to do. It was a great process, very cathartic. And everybody's got a story, and I recommend the process to everybody.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Is the book that we hold in our hands, or the book that everyone's going to be holding in their hands?
Everybody in the Western Hemisphere.
Yes, that's right.
For now, Eastern later.
Is this the book that you set out to write? Or did it take a life of its own as you began to write?
I'd say it certainly started out as one thing, and then it morphed into something much bigger, you know, what life lessons I learned along the way. And that's the part that I really hope, Richard, will resonate with people. Yes, come for the celebrity stories, stay for the life lessons. You know, we certainly hope that the bigger life lessons that I learned I hope they can.
You know, Jim, reading this, there are a lot of celebrity memoirs where names are dropped on every page.
Yeah.
I didn't get the sense, again, reading this book, that it's definitely not an expose of private moments with these celebrities. Right. It really is a celebration of the gifts that they each and every one bring to the table. And exactly. What you've gleaned from being able to break bread with these people, getting to horseback ride with John Fugelsang, writing in limousines with Elton John and, Carole King, all of these stories coming together, what you learn from each of these people.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I'm sure there was perhaps a book I could write of Jim Wilson tells all and shares the darkest, dirty secrets, but I have too much respect and admiration for all these artists. And that's the bigger message for me, is like, what did I gain from being in their jet stream? And what can I share that might be of service to other people in reading this book and following me on my journey and who I became in the process of pursuing my artistic aspirations?
This may seem like an unusual question, but I think you're going to get it. Do you think that your musical training helped you in terms of you as a writer now?
As a book writer and author? Yeah, I think there are certain disciplines. I thought you were going to go along the terms of music theory. And when I did play that melody for McCartney, I was really quite proud of myself because there was a little modulation in the middle of the chorus. And so we were listening, we're talking about the song. And I said, so how did you like the modulation in the chorus? He goes, it modulated. I said, well, yeah, it goes, we're in C, and it goes, and 2-5 up into E flat, and then 2-5 back down into C. And he goes, yeah, I like it when it goes from sort of the white keys to the black keys. And I took a beat and I thought, my gosh, there's no elbow in the rib here. This is really how this man who's changed the world with his music and certainly incorporates modulations in what he writes, this is how he kind of relates to it. And, you know, all those years of music theory training that I've taken, I certainly don't regret it because they're great tools. But as we learned, tools aren't rules. And here's a man who's written such extraordinary classics, and they come from a different place with a deeper understanding of the mechanics of music. But to your question of, did that kind of help me with writing? I suppose there is a similar thing, like the rhythm of the words. You know, there's number one, show, don't tell. Number two, create a scene for people. And a number of other things that I learned about the craft of writing. But there's also, how do the words trip across your tongue? And I love it when I can get a phrase that has like the power of three. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da. Mm. Even just the rhythm of it, you know, mm-hmm. And that's a win for me. I got, I'd give myself a brownie point every time I'd come up with something that had a nice flow to the rhythm of the words, you know, because I knew that this is going to be, I will do an audiobook later this year. And there's the thing of wanting to make it readable as you read the words, but also have it kind of flow. And there's a mellifluousness to the words. And so, yeah, that was, that's where I suppose there's an overlap in the musicality of it all.
And are the first words that we read in your book the first words that you wrote?
Yes. Is that introduction? So, mm-hmm. Yeah, hello. You must be Jim. And I'm guessing you must be, I want to say, Paul. So
I would have given anything to have been there. On so many levels.
Well, thank God. And sometimes I do kind of maybe go for, I always go for a moment of levity. It's just, it's in my nature. And I'm sure that I've crossed the line more than once where I thought, oh, Jesus, what the hell was I thinking?
I remember when, and we've become friends, Melissa Manchester.
Oh, she's a love. I love
her. I love her.
Yes,
and the first time she called me and she said, hello, Richard, it's Melissa. And I said, Melissa who? And she said, Melissa Manchester. And I knew it was her. Yeah. And she said, and I said, prove it. I said, well, how could I do that? And I said, I want 16 bars. Don't cry out loud. And she sat down at the piano and played it for me. That was right. It. We broke that ice. And that was, yes. That was just great. I'm always curious as to whose decision it is that this book is ready to fly. Was it yours? Was it the editor? Or was it the publisher?
Ultimately mine. And it passed through a lot of hands, and I'm really, really fortunate to have what I kind of called my informal committee. And I had literally about 24 beta readers. One's a successful TV writer and another one's this or that. And my writing coaches, and I, you know, just keep going and over. I probably did 10 drafts. And then after about the eighth draft, I kind of thought, I'm there, you know? And then I thought, okay, go through one more time and look for, is there any additional opportunity to use visuals? Because that's, you know, that's yet another level of bonus points, or where you can really see, you're using words that they're actually physical objects, and you can, you as the reader can see these things. And once I'd kind of manicured it to a point where I knew it was there, I thought, okay, we're ready.
So now that it's out there, are you going to be doing the audiobook yourself?
I think
so. Have you gone back and read this since you wrote it?
Yes. I'm proud of how it holds up, and mm-hmm. and I'm looking forward to reading it, you know. Yes, I can outsource that and pay a couple grand and have somebody read it, a professional narrator. But man, isn't it great to be able to hear the person's own voice and be able to, as you noted, a couple of different musical moments. I'll describe the musical moment, like that first moment of writing with Dan Fogelberg in a studio, and then I'll be able to cut to that music as an underscore. And so I'm looking forward to that.
And what is the ultimate takeaway that you are hoping that the reader, and I want to read in just a moment, your final words of the book, because that paragraph got me. But what is your ultimate takeaway?
Well, if you're going to read that paragraph, then you know that.
I'll tell you what, why don't you read it? I'd love to hear you read it.
Oh, wow. Well, let's just see. I just so happen to have a book. How about you read it and I'll read along with you.
Okay.
As I said, I'm a softie, and that writing that I really did. I know that I've landed on something good when it chokes me up writing it. And there were many, many sections in the book that did that. But to frame that moment, my ultimate mission is, if, yes, I want to entertain people, and I've been given some extraordinary one-off opportunities to be in the presence of some great people. But if my struggle as an artist and me achieving what I've achieved, in spite of seemingly insurmountable odds, can inspire somebody, particularly, you know, one of my grandkids, then that's enough for me. Just one or two people, if their lives are transfixed by that, transformed, then I'm in. So.
Did I start?
Yes, you may.
Dan was right. The calling to create art is indeed a sacred gift. I'm proud that I've created a body of music that will succeed me and might continue to bring joy to others. But more importantly, if the only thing my life accomplished was that my grandkids or my great niece and great nephews might one day read my story and be inspired to go for their dreams in spite of seemingly insurmountable obstacles. That's enough. When they're reaching for the brass ring, I hope they hear my voice whispering, take it. It's yours. That got me. That's great. I've enjoyed today so much.
As have I.
And this was just the icing on this cake. That's great. I'm going to give my closing remarks, and then I'm going to let you give yours. I'm going to leave the screen, and it's all yours. And when you say goodbye, I will end the show you so you don't have to worry about how to end this. It could be about anything that we spoke about today that you want to build upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message you want to leave everyone with today. My final message is the same final message that I give at the end of every show that I do, whether it be virtually or on stage, and that is to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. After today's show, everyone who's watching, whether you're watching this live or later, go to your Facebook friends list, and the seventh name that pops up, reach out with a phone call. Not an email message, not a text message, not a private inbox message, but a phone call. And let that person know the impact that they've made on your life. And if you do that, trust me, it's going to happen. You're going to make an impact on their life. I have a dear friend, Sean Moniger, and he always says, we're all in the same storm, but we're in different size boats. And I always say, I don't care what size boat you're on, as long as you have a skipper by your side. And with that, Jim, I'm going to leave the screen, and it's all yours. Thanks again for doing this today.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And I don't know if I can follow his sage words of wisdom, but I do hope that you've enjoyed our conversation. And I do hope that this book, you find value in it. And like I said, my biggest desire with this book is that it serves to inspire somebody to pursue a dream against the odds. Be good to each other.